This is Maggie Jones and Natural Wonders. I'm going to read again from the book Wrong Tree, Adventures in Wildlife Biology by Jeff Wilson. Illustrations by Terry Dalton. This will be the sixth reading I've done from this book. This time, we're going to learn a lot about loons and the work that's been done to learn from loons and the perils that they face. The subchapter is called Covert Operation. In the winter of 2009, Kevin called to ask if Terry and I wanted to work for him on a contract again that summer. And this is previously mentioned. Kevin Kino, he and Mike Meyer were going to use satellite telemetry devices that would be surgically implanted inside a sample of loons. The technique had been successfully tested by Kevin, and the battery transmitter would be implanted inside the body cavity with the antenna emerging low on the loon's back, just above the tail. The transmitter sent a signal to a satellite so he would be able to track birds on his computer all year long. I was intrigued. Back in the 1980s, Jerry B. Lant had tried some radio telemetry devices on loons without success. We discovered that due to the lifestyle and physiology of loons, they're a difficult species for attaching external telemetry transmitters. Consider these facts. Loons can dive deep, over 200 feet, and can fly 70 miles an hour. But to get airborne, they need a quarter-mile runway. Unlike most birds, loons have solid bones rather than hollow. Most birds are adapted to be light for flight, but for loons, there must have been an evolutionary trade-off between flying and diving. Solid bones aren't as susceptible to being crushed by underwater pressure. Being heavy helps loons dive deeper, but that also makes getting up in the air a challenge. Unlike many birds, loons can't soar or hover and have to flap continuously to stay airborne, so adding more weight with a telemetry device could make an already difficult takeoff even harder. The transmitter's weight was well below the 5% rule recommended by the Bird Banding Lab. Loons also have thick, dense, oily feathers to keep them warm and dry while on the water. They preen frequently, adding oil from a gland located near their tail to keep them water-sealed, so any kind of harness you put over the plumage could cause a leak in the feathers and get the loon wet and cold. Jerry B. Lant tested a few different harnesses and a poncho contraption for carrying telemetry transmitters, but in each instance, the loons got wet and had trouble thermoregulating, so the equipment had to be removed. The backpack harness style has been used on hawks, owls, woodcocks, and rough grouse, but was no good for loons. Plastic neck collars, like those we put on geese and swans, won't work either because loons need to be able to expand their necks to swallow large fish. The collar might cause them to choke, or if it was big enough to allow for swallowing, it would probably fall off. During Mike's loon mercury research project, questions had arisen such as potential for sources of mercury during migration. Kevin said that his technique would allow them to track loons during migration and wintering. To date, records on migration routes were mostly from recovery of banded birds that died. This technique would help us more clearly define migration routes, wintering grounds, potential threats, and critical habitats. This internal implant sounds risky, I said. How do you safely implant the transmitter? Kevin explained that he had first developed the surgery techniques for implants on waterfowl and then tested it on loons, conducting the surgeries himself. Later, he had trained a veterinary surgeon with U.S. Geological Survey in Alaska who shared the knowledge with other veterinary surgeons, and they had lots of experience. One was a vet from the University of Florida, and Kevin was bringing him in as part of the team. Terry and I were both a little queasy about this method. On a gut level, it felt a little scary. Over the years, we had developed quite an affection for our research birds. We always felt a little guilty about all the interruptions we caused our loons as we counted eggs, conducted time activity budgets, and captured and banded the birds. We always did our best to minimize our impacts, but in reality, any time you interfere with a wild animal, you have to accept the fact that you could inadvertently harm it. For that reason, methods were carefully scrutinized and protocols were set up to reduce impacts as much as possible. When we brought this up, Kevin explained the rationale for this project and his protocols in more detail. His testing included a 3-year study in New York, Maine, and New Hampshire that developed protocols. He told us that the previous fall, during migration, hundreds of dead loons had washed up on the Lake Michigan shore, especially on the northern shores, including Sleeping Bear Dunes National Lakeshore. The necropsies of the dead loons showed they died from botulism E. Their digestive tracts contained an invasive fish called the round goby, and it was suspected that gobies were getting the botulism from eating zebra mussels, another invasive species common in the lower Great Lakes. These two invaders had entered Lake Michigan in the ballast water of ocean-going cargo vessels. Kevin and Mike wanted to collect more data on the distribution and foraging patterns of loons and other water birds related to these botulism die-offs. They felt that the satellite data would help to pin down these tricky migration questions. Terry and I offered to help, and the first step was to locate birds for the study. Kevin had 10 radio transmitters to implant for the pilot project in Wisconsin and Minnesota. He thought that the turtle flambeau flowage would be a good research site because we had as many as 32 pairs of loons and could easily find 7 pairs with chicks, which would mean we could be sure to catch the adults. He only wanted to put the transmitters in males because he was not sure whether the abdominal implant would affect egg development in females, and he didn't want to risk losing fertility in a bird. We would still put a geotag on the leg band of the females. That spring, Terry and I started checking our loon territories, and by June had found 7 pairs with chicks. We informed Bruce Bacon, as well as the local DNR warden. Mike was monitoring pairs, and the biologists in Minnesota were also tracking candidate loons. The first surgeries were done on Minnesota birds. For the Wisconsin implant candidates, our crew did the captures with Kevin's U.S. Geological Survey staff, and the veterinarian managed the surgeries. Kevin wanted Terry to drive the capture boat, and he wanted me on shore to help with handling. Then he asked if I could find a place near the loon pairs to park the FEMA trailer. FEMA trailer, I asked. Aren't they the small trailers the federal government gave people to live in down in New Orleans after Hurricane Katrina? That's right, Kevin said. He explained that the USGS had one converted into a medical surgery lab. The trailer was 30 feet long, set up with bright lights and running water, and had a gas generator that ran the power. Could we find a parking lot where they could park this trailer, as well as other trucks and boats? They thought they'd start at about 10 p.m. and should be done by 5 in the morning. I thought a minute. Mercer is a small town of 800 people, and people love to gossip. People also love conspiracy theories, and I started imagining what some of the locals would think if they drove by our operation in the middle of the night, seeing not only a big trailer with U.S. government FEMA written across it, but a bunch of trucks with federal government license plates and people with headlamps. Even worse, what if they looked in the trailer window and saw people with surgical gloves and masks doing surgery? I had a vision of another Roswell. When an urban legend got going that the government was covering up a Martian landing or UFOs, my fears were groundless. All went well. It took 2 nights to implant the transmitters in 7 loons, and Terry and I monitored them during their recovery. The 7 males were back with the females and chicks on their territory the next day, and they all survived. The following fall and spring, Kevin followed the loons on their migration, even setting up a website for citizens to follow the loons online. Most of the loons used Lake Michigan as a stopover site, as Mike and Kevin had suspected. It was fascinating to watch via computer as they hopscotched their way south. Most went to the Gulf of Mexico, a few to the Atlantic coast, and one even wintered in open water on a lake down in Indiana. The next spring, Kevin and I watched as the birds migrated back and we re-caught them with our lift net trap. We removed the geotags and examined the birds. I was amazed at their health and vitality. The antenna exit location was completely healed and fused to the body as if the antenna had been there all along. That summer, we implanted transmitters on an additional 5 birds in Wisconsin, 13 in Minnesota, and 3 in Michigan. Each year's data was made available online so the public could click on each bird and watch its travel route. It was especially interesting to see how quickly the loons migrated from southern Lake Michigan to the Gulf Coast, sometimes traveling the distance in just 2 or 3 days. At one point, the project became really popular with the locals, and some of the taverns in Mercer ran a lottery to see who could guess which loons would return first. The batteries continued to transmit for up to 24 months, and at this writing have long since gone silent. Last spring, Terry and I saw 3 of the antenna birds still in their old territories. The antenna is still visible with binoculars. Nobody in Mercer ever noticed our 2-night covert operation. Kevin's loon satellite telemetry data ended up serving Wisconsin, Minnesota, and Michigan in an unexpected way. On April 20, 2010, an oil rig, now known as the Deepwater Horizon, blew up, spilling 4.9 million barrels of oil into the Gulf of Mexico. Dave Evers' crew in Maine was awarded the contract from the federal government and British Petroleum, BP, to study the impact of the oil spill on loons. Because Kevin had expanded his migration study into Minnesota and Michigan, his satellite telemetry research was used to document the extent to which Great Lakes loons wintered in the area of the oil spill. Minnesota was in line to receive economic compensation from BP for Midwest loon losses, with the hope of further protecting loon nesting habitat and replacing the birds lost to the oil spill. I suspect Wisconsin missed out on that pot of money because the political winds had shifted and research was no longer a priority for our state administration. In 2015, the Republican-controlled government reorganized the DNR and gutted the budgets, eliminating most research scientists and focusing wildlife work on game species. Without a reliable state agency partner, the federal government opted to send those BP funds to a state more prepared to value its loons. And now on to another part of this chapter, Pink Rock Rescue. It was the middle of April and my wife Terry was visiting friends in Upper Michigan for the week. Kevin Kino and his assistant Steve Howdick had come up from La Crosse to do some early spring loon catching and retrieving of geotags. We were working on the Turtle Flambeau, which is a fairly remote wild place any time of the year, but in April it is virtually deserted. Fishing season doesn't open till the first weekend in May, and April is too cold for camping. When we left the dock that spring morning for a day of loon capture, we took lunches and extra clothing. I'd left my cell phone behind. I tend to forget my cell phone, and besides, I thought it might get wet. April can bring some tough weather, and we can have snow as late as May. The day was brisk, and the water was mighty cold. Ice had gone out only the previous week. The day went well, and about an hour before dusk, we decided to try to catch one more bird, the Pink Rock male. We often named our pairs after a feature of the lake in their nesting territory. In this case, there was a big pink rock, rose quartz, that projected out of the water like a small island about the size of a Greyhound bus. The previous year, a pair of loons had nested off a little gravel shoal at the base of the rock and produced chicks. The pink rock male was one of Kevin's satellite telemetry implant birds, and we needed to catch it and remove the geotag attached to its leg band. When we got there to set up our capture nets, we picked a location on a small one-acre island 100 yards from Pink Rock. We landed and set up the lift net trap, and Kevin and Steve hid in the shrubbery. After everything was set up, I couldn't find a good place to hide the boat, so I left Kevin and Steve to do the catching, and I motored over to Pink Rock and hid myself and the boat behind the rock. Watching through binoculars, I could see perfectly. They started blasting out loon calls. The loon saw the decoy and responded, heading for the decoy and net. As I watched, the net came up, and I could see splashing. Kevin and Steve ran into the water to retrieve the bird. I jumped in the boat to head over and help. Now, I didn't tear out of there at high speed. I backed out, turned the boat around, and steadily increased the throttle. The problem was that it was almost dark, and I couldn't see into the water very well, so I ended up taking a slightly different route than when I'd pulled in. A moment later, wham! The boat lifted a little and stopped. I had found Pink Rock's sister. This rock was 4 inches under the water and about the size of a Volkswagen Beetle. I wasn't worried. The turtle flambeau is full of stumps and rock bars, and I'd been stuck on plenty of them. Usually all you have to do to free yourself is move all the way to the other end of the boat, put the motor in reverse, and give her the throttle. The combination of weight shift and thrust allows you to back off the underwater obstruction. This time that technique didn't work. I was high-centered on that rock with the aluminum hull of my boat. It bobbed like a teeter-totter. I tried everything. I stuck an oar down but couldn't touch bottom. The water, it turned out, was over 10 feet deep everywhere around the boat. I had on chest waders, so I tried getting out on the rock to push, but it was slimy, slippery, and slanting. I could not get a firm boothold to push from. By now, Kevin and Steve were done processing the loon. They stood on the shoreline of the island watching me rev the outboard and spinning around in circles, trying to get off the rock. It was getting darker, and I realized I had their extra clothing in the boat. As I tried different escape tactics, I thought about the fact that nobody knew where we were, and it could be days before anybody casually came by, perhaps not for 2 weeks until fishing season opened. I gave up my attempts to escape. The boat wasn't moving, and now it was dark. I yelled at the top of my lungs to Kevin, "Do you have a cell phone?" "Yes," he yelled back. Kevin's island was about 100 yards away, and I could hardly hear him. "Do you have reception?" I called out. "Yes," he said, "one bar." This meant his phone would barely reach the cell tower to transmit a call. "Call my son Zach," I yelled. We could barely hear each other due to the distance, and it took about 4 tries before he got the 10-digit number right. "Where do I tell him we are?" Kevin yelled. "Just tell him Pink Rock. He'll know." Luckily, the call went through. About 2 hours later, I saw a faint light on the horizon. It was pitch dark by then, but I could see that the light was getting closer. The turtle flambeau flowage had hired a new seasonal ranger for the summer named Kenny Pemble. Kenny had just that day gotten his ranger boat out and prepared it for the upcoming season. Kenny was a friend of Zach's and grew up in the house next door to ours. Boy, were we glad to see them. They got to me first, hooked a rope to the boat, and pulled with their 90-horsepower outboard. It took them 3 tries to get me off that rock. Then we retrieved Kevin and Steve from the island. On the way back to the dock, Kevin said he had considered leaving his phone in the truck, not wanting it to get wet. And I'll stop there. I'm reading from the book Wrong Tree, Adventures in Wildlife Biology by Jeff Wilson, illustrations by Terry Dalton, and published by the Cornerstone Press in Stevens Point. This is Maggie Jones and Natural Wonders. Thank you so much for listening.